This is Vectis Radio. For the people, by the people.
Welcome to Joe Plum's political soapbox on Vectis Radio.
Yes, we can.
Because Brexit means Brexit.
This, Mr. President, is a remarkable record.
The Isle of Wight Zoo is having difficulty importing a tiger.
My father gave me a small loan of $1 million.
Which we wouldn't have if we listened to the muttering idiot sitting opposite me.
On the show today, we have Jonathan Bacon. Hello, you're listening to Joe Plum's Political Soapbox here on Vectis Radio. Joining me in the studio today, we have Jonathan Bacon, the Isle of Wight Council leader. Good afternoon, Jonathan.
Good afternoon. Very pleased to be here.
From the Isle of Wight Island Independence Party.
Not a party.
This is what I wanted to start off with. How does that work? So you are the leader of a number of independent people, but surely they all have very different political opinions on certain things. How do you pull all these people together?
Because the one thing that unites us, and I'd hope would unite the island, is a desire to help the island and its residents, particularly its residents. That was the way the group came together. Yes, we are politically quite disparate. You'll have a range of views if you look at the party political spectrum across the group, but so what? Because as long as people are actually believing in the island and looking to what they can do for the island, that's the driving force behind the group. And it must be a pretty strong driving force, because it's kept 16 of us together through very stormy waters, it must be said, over the last 3 years. Some have fallen by the wayside. I think those who have just don't have those particular interests at heart. We've seen people who've decided to pursue their own party interests over the interests of the island, or their own personal interests over the interests of the island. But the love of the island and the desire to do something for it is a strong uniting force. And that, as I say, is what the Island Independent Group is all about. And you must excuse me, I've got a bit of a cold, so I'm stumbling over my words occasionally. I may cough a bit, so I apologise for that.
So how does it work when you're creating policy and things like that to go through with the council, when you've got all these different views and opinions? I know they're all focused on the island, but how do you pull all these people and whip them around to make sure they're voting along the way that they should on a whole host of different issues? And also
we don't have a whip. The answer to your question, you almost answered it yourself, is in what you bring forward, the quality of what you bring forward. If we bring forward something that is right for the island, then I'd hope that everyone would follow it. And of course, it's absolutely the case that we don't have a majority as a group in the council. We are 16 out of 40. So we're not going to get anything through unless we can actually draw others in to vote for it and support it. And that's what we've managed to do, because I'd like to think we're actually bringing forward things that, particularly in the circumstances we are, particularly financially at the moment, we're doing the right things and the best things we can with the equipment, the finances we've got.
So as a voting islander, when I see Island Independent, what am I going to get for that if I'm voting independent? How do I know what your party, what your group is standing for, what message you want to get across, what kind of island we'll be looking for the future, when I've got all these separate people?
Well, I think fundamentally you are voting for the individual. And I think at the very root of what we're about is making sure that each resident, each ward, has a good councillor that will represent the issues of that ward those residents. So that's got to be absolutely fundamental. And then it grows from there, because if we're doing that, we're hopefully doing the things that the residents, the ward, the island want and will work for the island. So you are getting... I mean, the one promise I made when I was knocking on doors last time round is that I will do my best for my residents and I will do the best I can for the island. And sometimes you have some ideas of what we want to do. I mean, we're launching at the moment a big regeneration programme, and I'm sure we can talk about that in a moment. We are also, and some things like that you plan, some things we have to be reactive. We've had to be very reactive to the attitude of government in relation to finance to the island, and trying to find a way through that so that we can pull together the finances of the council, because that's essential to be able to offer the services that people need. we always use that generic term services without really explaining it, but it's absolutely everything the council does, whether it's waste collections, keeping the waste collections at 2 weeks, whether it's adults services, care homes, funding care homes, looking after children, children's services, looking after our children in care, yet the whole range of things. There's so many things the council is involved in, and sort of from the top level, what you need to do is make sure you create a structure and a financial structure that means that all those things that people sometimes they don't even realise they're benefiting from them, but they need them, and so they're getting the best chance of getting the best service.
So if we have that political spectrum from the left to the right, whereabouts do you think the independents as a group and the independent council would fall under that?
Well, as I say, if if you looked at individual members, you'd probably go right across the range. But I suppose centre-left is where we'd probably find a more unified home. I'd probably offend some of the bluer members of the group, if I can put them like that, in saying that. But I think you'd identify that that desire to really concentrate on what the residents and what the residents need. That's and one notable instance in the council chamber, I think it was last year, one of my colleagues, Julia Baker-Smith, was accused of being a socialist because she was supporting something for, I think it was for homeless people. Well, who cares if it's socialism, if it's communism, if it's fascism, if it's actually, well, so I don't misquote me on that, but if it's something that's actually supporting the residents and helping the residents and what they need, I don't care where it is on the political spectrum. If it's good for the island, it's good for the residents. That's what we do. And as I say, if you want to bracket it in some way, I suppose that puts us somewhere in the centre left.
So what do you think the biggest problem facing islanders is today?
The biggest problem facing islanders, from my perspective as council leader, is the finances of the island and the economy of the island. And I can reel off a lot of figures, I'm more than happy to do so, but essentially we've had a massive swathe of cuts through the government austerity programme over the last 5 years, and those are set to continue. And well, I will put some figures on it. When we came in as an independent administration, the sort of basic operating budget of the council from which we have to provide services, 180 million. It's now down to about 120. We're being told we have to take another 20 out of that. So we've lost over a third of the funding that we have and we need to actually provide children's services, adult services, and so on. And it makes it extremely difficult. Some things we have lost. We lost an awful lot under the previous administration. There was very much a slash, cut and burn sort of attitude. What we're trying to do, and again, you're asking what do you get from an independent administration, is trying to look at it more creatively. We've only got so much money. I don't like that phrase that's sometimes used by the MP, cut the cloth. That just suggests you get rid of things. What we try and do and say is to say people still need services, they still need libraries, they still need care, they still need mental health support. Can we find another way, a cheaper way it has to be, but another way of providing that within the budget we've got? So it's not just getting rid of things, which I think we had far too much of in the past. And I must say, I think we probably passed a point maybe around 2012 where some parts of the old style council operation have become irrecoverable, and we've been permanently damaged in a way. But we have to look at doing the best we can with what we've got, but that means not getting rid of things, but seeing how we can provide what people need.
Is devolution a possible solution to those finance problems?
We thought it might, well, in a roundabout way, yes. I mean, obviously what's happened now is through, it seems, a lot of political manoeuvring, blue political manoeuvring, we've been knocked out of that process. The basis of devolution is the handing down of powers from central government to local government, and I think a lot of what the island suffers from is decisions being made in Westminster with simply no regard for what the particular precious concerns are on the island. But what devolution was coming with, it was referred to as a deal, and very much a deal, and there are two sides to a deal. I know there are things that people didn't like the sound of, the idea of a mayor between the areas. That's something the government made absolutely clear they wouldn't go ahead without. But on the plus side for us, I suppose two things we were looking at particularly. The first was an investment pot. Excuse me. An investment pot amounting to £900 million over 30 years. Now, a lot of people tried to say, can we be sure that exists? Don't believe you, that money's just going to be taken up running the authority. No, it wasn't. It was an investment pot. Yes, it was going to be divvied out between the various members of the group, but it was money to be used to invest in particularly infrastructure, to start building up the basis of the island's economy. That is a benefit to the island, because if we can increase our business rate base, which is very low, if we can get the right sort of housing we need to mean that we're creating jobs and people have got the houses they can afford to be able to come here and do those jobs, you start building your council tax base. That means we've got more financial security. That means we can keep providing the services that people need. The other half of devolution was really getting local control. We know that so-called business rate retention is coming down the track for the country. That is a means by which, as you, I'm sure you know, Joe, at the moment when business rates are collected in any part of the country, half is kept locally, half is sent up to government. The idea to make areas more self-sufficient is you keep all your business rates in an area. And again, that gives us our money back and more local control over that money. We don't give half of it away and then government doesn't give it back to us, as it feels like. And there'll be someone out there who's saying, yes, but we have a low business rate base, we're not going to survive off that, and you're absolutely right, but it would certainly help. It would give us more local control over money rather than government just taking away chunks year after year. We know we would go into any process having to rely on a top-up system whereby we will need more money from government, and that's going to carry on. This island is probably never going to be financially self-sustaining, but if we had more control over more money, that can only be good for the island, because frankly people on the island, I'm not talking about myself here, I'm talking islanders, those who tell the politicians what to do, they have a better idea of what to do with the island's finances than someone sitting in Westminster who, I mean, we had one notorious instance about 3 or 4 years ago where someone was coming down to visit us. They didn't realise they had to get a ferry. They didn't actually realise there was a bit of water to cross, and you're dealing with that sort of attitude sometimes with Westminster people.
What's, as a council leader, what is your relationship with Westminster? How much involvement do you have with them? Is there any kind of communication or any links between them?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, with the previous Secretary of State for Local Government, Greg Clark, as you know, he actually came down to visit us. I had a number of meetings with him. We're in fairly regular contact with the civil servants in that department, or indeed in other departments I work in. We work with. I, of course, look after the education children services side of things. So again, we have connections generally with civil servants, but an ongoing dialogue. Obviously, there's been quite a bit of quite a few ructions up in Westminster this year, and they're settling down a bit, so we haven't probably built our new relationship with the new Secretary of State for Department for excuse me, I'm gonna have to cough again. We haven't really built our relationship with the new Secretary of State for Local Government. I've met him once, and that gave us bad news about devolution, but he's undertaken to meet again and discuss the particular situation of the Isle of Wight. And, you know, that's where the decisions are made, so that's where we have to make sure we have a voice. We are going there, we are securing meetings, to get the point across, to get the case across about what is different about the island, what is unique about the island, and why we frankly do need to be treated differently.
Okay, we're going to go to an ad break now, and then when we come back we'll talk about your role in education and children's services.
Certainly.
And
yeah,
the future for those things, and some of the issues surrounding that.
I'm James, and I present the afternoon show on Wednesdays with my wife Judy. We came into radio in a kind of funny roundabout way, I suppose. We set up a community cinema in Bembridge and then we were interviewed on Vectis Radio, and we liked it so much that we refused to get out of the studio. That was over 2 years ago now. I think the station's a great way of reaching and engaging people on the island who aren't served by the mainstream media here. We've recently been working on several community shows to help particular groups on the island. We introduced the Visit Isle of Wight show because we wanted to help attract tourists to the island. We also set up the hospice show to give patients, visitors and volunteers a chance to get involved with radio. It's a great way for them to promote what they do and hopefully have a lot of fun. We also recently added some LGBTQ content to the show, and we've been busy working with the Isle of Wight College to help students with drama radio projects. It's great being able to promote so much of what is good on the island, and we love doing it. Vectis Radio gave us a platform to get involved at the heart of the community, and I know it gives many others something to be passionate about. It's wonderful to be part of something that, in my view, gives so much back to the island.
Stories like these are what make community radio so special. If you would like to donate to Vectis Radio and help the station as it moves towards going FM in 2017, go to justgiving.com/crowdfunding/Vectis-radio. Vectis Radio, bringing the community together.
Hello, you're listening to Joe Plum's Political Soapbox. Today on the show we have Council Leader Jonathan Bacon, who has come in to talk to us all about politics and the council and everything that's going on at the moment.
Slightly distracted at the moment because a pixie's trying to break into the studio.
We've got lots of people coming, Mitch. It's fine.
You got any presents?
You're right. what I wanted to do is just... Are we all right?
Technical issues over this side of the desk.
What I wanted to do is just talk about some of the big news stories that have come up this week, so we can just clarify and get your opinion about certain things that have happened. So we heard in the Isle of Wight news earlier about comments by Councillor Whitehouse saying that there is a vindictive legal pursuit against John Platt and the school fines problem. Do you think the council have gone too far with this pursuit?
No, I think Councillor Whitehouse, as usual, has gone too far. I'm also amazed that this came up this week because he's referring to something that happened last June. We know that there was the initial appeal at the High Court, and we know that the Department of Education have decided that this matter needs to be taken further because the law needs to be clarified, and it's about getting the law right. That is what this is about. Very simply, it comes down to what does the phrase regular attendance mean for school attendance provisions? Because no one, go and ask an education professional and they won't be able to tell you.
Yeah.
There's no figure attached to it. All we know is that there's regular attendance, or regular attendance is required in relation to potential penalties for non-attendance at school. But it is one of the dark arts almost to try and determine when that kicks in and when it doesn't, and so very simply the case comes down to it's almost not about the result but about just having a clear piece of law to say what does regular attendance mean for parents and for children and for schools, because the uncertainty is causing a lot of problems. And so that's all that case was about originally. It's been thrown into disarray, and the Department of Education have recognised there's a problem. That's why they're trying to pick this case up. They've promised to fund it completely and try and just sort it out so we know, whatever the definition is, that we've got a definition.
What would you like to see the definition of that regular attendance be? Is it something that, do you think people should be fined for taking their children out for holidays, or should we leave these fines for those people whose attendance is dipping to an incredibly low percent that they are regularly unattending school? So they're not, you know, they are not turning
up. What do you have in mind when you say they are missing, they're dipping so low?
Students whose percentage falls, say, I mean...
To what level?
That I've worked in, if it falls below 95%, then you start that process of getting the parents in, making sure they have an attendance plan, and then if it falls below 80%, then you have concerns and you push forward. But spending...
So you're pitching at 95%, others are pitching it at 90%. Your previous knowledge of schools would probably tell you there's this concept of persistent absence,
yeah,
where you take... much stricter action, the level for that, the threshold for that, raised either earlier this year or last year to 90%. So we've got a situation now where I know some are contending that 90% is acceptable attendance. Do we suddenly go from 90% acceptable to 91% acceptable, 90% persistently absent, severe measures take place? That strikes me as an odd situation. There's no middle ground between the two. So it really just goes, I think that in itself shows that there is a real lack of clarity here as to the provisions, and therefore we need to just have some certainty. And that's got to be informed by people who understand education, understand the importance of attendance. There'll be some who say it has to be 100%, and I'm sure that's much better for children's education, but it's probably impractical. Where do we go? Do we go 95%? Do we go 90%? If we go 90%, that sounds like it's very odd when compared to the persistent absence situation. So I'm being a little unclear because the situation is unclear, and that is the problem. And when parents don't know what the situation is, that gives them a problem, and particularly it gives schools a problem when they're trying to determine, are the children going to come up? How do I plan lessons? What do I do with the ones who are not turning up? Because, well, if you take 90%, as being pointed out, that gives the ability to remove children from school for whatever reason for just over 2 weeks. That's going to seriously dent a child's education. But particularly, you've got to think of the school as a whole and the children as a whole. How can a teacher readily cope with having to possibly even presume that each of her pupils is going to be away for at some point for 2 weeks over the year? It drags everyone back. So there are lots of issues here.
But there are wider things to looking at the benefits of students going out and exploring things and going on holiday. And if they cannot afford to go on holiday during school holiday times because of the hike in prices, because of what they're doing, then you've got the problem of, they can't afford to do that, so then they're taking them out of during school time. But the students can benefit. They're not learning when they're on holiday.
Yeah,
they can go out and explore
yes.
live things, which can add, boost their well-being, boost their opinion of school when they come back. Because if they've had a good experience and they've been able to do this, then they can celebrate school.
Yeah, so we need to know with the parameters within which that can happen. And we don't.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this has been painted as the school holidays case, and there are other moves suggesting, well, let's change the school terms, the school term system. Perfectly happy to have that debate. I think there's some work going on at the moment. There's actually a consultation with schools each and every year saying, are they happy with the school dates? Do you want to move things? But you've got to look at all the things behind that. There are certain things that are written in stone, like Easter, Christmas, the exam schedule that we have to adhere to. There's not too much radical change you can do without moving possibly even some bank holidays and so on, and certainly rewriting the exam system to achieve that. So you've only got a certain amount of flexibility there. So I lost my track slightly.
That's
there.
Right.
So
the system, let's talk about schools in general with in regards to last under the last administration, we had the big shake-up of going down to the two-tier system, the split up for middle schools. We're now only now seeing students who've actually gone through that whole process and getting the grades. So this summer's exam results are kind of testament to those students who've been through the two-tier system all the way through, and they've not had years at primary school extra and all sorts of things that were happening. Do you think the standard of education on the Isle of Wight is good enough?
No.
And what do you think the council should be doing to help improve
well,
that?
Well, we are working extremely hard to make it better by actively helping schools in the classroom. And I think, you know, we have to be judged by Ofsted. It has its critics, but it is the measure. And of course, if there's some measure of what's happened over the last 3.5 years, we have moved from a situation where 25% of schools were in a category, were not performing as they should be, and we're down to 2% now, one primary school. And I'd hope, you know, if one accepts there has to be a measure and that is the measure, that shows that the quality of education is improving. No, it is not good enough. We have to look at the results as well, and each year they're a little bit of a mixed bag, but certainly they're going up. They're not going up as fast as I would like, but the trajectory is right. So we need to carry on getting education professionals, staff, support staff into the classroom, finding out what needs to be done, sharing knowledge and experience, sharing support, so that the staff who work incredibly hard in the schools have the best chance of making the best of the pupils. And if you come back to attendance, attendance is part of that process. It's notable that the attendance levels have improved greatly in parallel with the standards going up. And if you look at any system where the standards are down, as ours was, say, 4 years ago, you can pretty much guarantee that attendance is part of that picture. So again, coming back to what we were saying earlier, it's really part of a very big mix, that issue.
I know a few years ago the children's services system changed slightly, where people and organisations could go that money put up for tender and they can run things. I know Ventnor Town Council do a lot, and the 4Ps project.
Oh, we're talking about the youth offer.
The
yes,
youth
yes,
offer, yeah.
Yes, certainly.
And how that works. Will that be continuing this year? Because I know that funding is up for renewal.
The funding was originally arranged to run through to March 2017. I've been in a number of meetings. There was one public meeting in the Riverside Centre actually about a month ago, where I said I was going to work as much as I could to get something in place. Yes, we are going to have a system. We're not going to be able to provide as much money, but it's certainly not going to be what people were fearing, which is cutting it off completely. A lot of work is being done, and you mentioned Ventnor. They have Tony, who's, I must apologise to him because I can't remember his surname, but a chap called Tony there has done a fantastic amount looking at the current youth providers to bring them together into sort of collective supporting organisation, and we're going to support and fund that. But what I want to see is all those across the island that are providing some sort of support or youth service are brought into the family. I think one thing that was wrong with the youth offer, and hindsight is a great thing, of course, is that certain groups were selected to be part of that magic group, and obviously Vectis Radio is one of those, and in fact I was part of helping Ian to write the 4Ps course, so I'm well aware of the start of the process. But I think it's left other groups a little out in the cold, and so what we want to make sure is we bring all the groups together under a collective head, which can be a mutual support network, etc., and there will be funding for those who need it. We can't find as much money as this. I told you the sort of figures we're dealing with, but we will make sure there's a significant sum of money and support within the council for those groups, so that the good work that, say, the 4Ps, etc., do can carry on.
Thank you. One of the things that keeps getting mentioned on the show with the different guests is the Solent barrier problem, in the fact that it's a barrier to employment, to education, to funding, all sorts of things. What do you think would be the best solution to help with that Solent barrier?
I know where you're going with this, but fundamentally I think we've got to identify that as an island surrounded by water, it gives us a lot of issues that aren't had on the mainland, and that needs to be taken into account in the government funding system. We've said that the island will never be self-sustaining, we've said it's always going to need support, and that support needs to recognise our unique characteristic. Within England, we've only got the Scilly Isles as any sort of comparator, and even they are very different from us. So we have had recognition from government that we are unique, and there's something coming along called the Fair Funding Review, which we are submitting tons of information to about how that water, that barrier as you refer to it, affects us, so that will hopefully be taken account of. The other thing though is we can play to our strengths as an island. We've also got to remember that there are other features about the place. The fact that we are 50% area of outstanding natural beauty, we're never going to be a place that's going to have lots of heavy industry here. We're also a place where one fear I have about, if we mention the fixed link, if you put that in place, there's going to be a massive drive to make this basically a housing state for South Portsmouth. I may be being a little over dramatic there, but if you look at the cities over the other side of the water, they're surrounded by the suburbs. If you suddenly open up easy access to the Isle of Wight, I've got a fear there. But the island is utterly unsuitable for that mass growth of housing. You see the reaction people have when you suggest there's going to be a new housing development. So what we can actually provide, though, is being a tourist destination, but also, and I think this really isn't recognised, high-level industry, intelligent industry that doesn't rely on containers having to come across the water. But if you look at some of the stuff that's being made on the island, GKN will tell you they make components that probably are in every aircraft flying. We've got what they called peripherals, airplane peripherals over in West Wight. There's so much high quality innovative work on the island, and we can really build on that. And it doesn't matter a jot whether there's water there or not. But we seem to have an environment, a great place to live, that can attract those sort of great minds and to do that sort of work. And I think we actually want to stop thinking so much about there being barriers, but thinking about looking at the positives that our situation, our unique situation, gives us, and building on those, developing those, and making the most we can out of those.
You talked about the island not being able to be financially sufficient. Do we think that the island could one day become a truly green island where we have wind turbines that support? There was a report saying that we'd only need 15 offshore wind turbines and we could power the whole of the Isle of Wight. Do we think we can become a green, self-sustained island?
I think so. Wind turbines are... some people are now saying that they're yesterday's technology, but I think it was a great shame for the island that the Navitas wind project failed, and that failed due to opposition on the mainland. This was the one that was going to be situated off, allegedly visible from Bournemouth. But that was going to bring a lot to the island. We've got what's happening down with Perpetuous off the South Wight. This is what I mean about innovation, a really high-level testing bed for tidal energy there. And that could bring forward some stuff that, yes, could provide a fantastic amount of energy and support for the island. I think we need to be a little more clever than just the ideas of sticking a 60-metre turbine in the middle of the West Wight. That's just been proved not it's not going to be acceptable. But there's stuff offshore, there's the tidal stuff. All that sort of stuff needs to be looked at and could greatly help. We are also through solar energy at the moment. There are some very big areas of solar panels out there. Sometimes you see them in the winter when the foliage has died down, but you don't see them in the summer. But we are probably close to actually being an area that could pretty much support ourselves from solar energy and the renewable energy we've got at the moment. We could, if the technology was there to take it back over to the mainland, almost become an exporter of energy. So I think it's all there. It has to develop with the times. It has to become more and more sustainable. I've always been particularly a supporter of tidal energy. That's the one utterly predictable and reliable form of natural energy in my mind. And the more we can develop, the more we can support ourselves, the more we can potentially create a source of revenue by selling that energy to others who don't have the benefit of, we're talking about benefits of having been surrounded by water and tides. See, it all ties up. That's a benefit we could work on.
They're very interesting, especially about those solar panels. I've seen a lot of them around in some of the farm fields and stuff. And it's good to see that's working really well. What has been your biggest challenge as council leader so far?
I thought you said this was only an hour-long show. Gosh, that's quite a question to throw at someone. I think it's been to cope with the financial situation that we've been faced with. I gave the figures earlier. We've had a third of our budget taken away, and the challenge to try and maintain services for residents in the face of that loss of income, that's been the absolute core of it. There are obviously other big challenges, and again, I'd mention improving standards on education, because that's the particular area I've been working very hard to make sure we deal with. But again, that has to be dealt with within that financial framework. We see now very concerningly the school's budget effectively being cut by government, and all that good work we're putting in, you know, that places it at risk. So it really does come down to the finances.
We're going to play our weekly game of Prime Minister's Questions, which are 20 questions of just because we've only got an hour.
You're catching me there because I have to admit that I haven't managed to listen to you. my other job is doing holiday lets, and so Saturdays are usually I'm there with my penny and my pledge and changing the beds and whatever. So I've never managed to listen to this. So I haven't got the advantage of knowing what these questions are in advance.
They're 20 questions just to find out your opinion on some of the big things, is we've obviously only got an hour today and we can only talk about a set number of issues, so
sure.
We want to try and find out those things. So question number one is, are you for or against a fixed link?
I'm against.
Should we allow fracking on the Isle of Wight?
No.
What is the biggest problem facing the island today?
Finance.
Are you a spender or a saver?
Do you mean as a councillor?
As a person, I think.
I'm probably a spender.
And what about as a councillor?
I'm probably a prudent saver.
What's the best thing about UK politics?
The best thing? Gosh. The fact that we have a democratic system.
And one word to describe Brexit? Without swearing.
I can't put it in one word. It's the will of the people.
What is the worst thing about politics in the UK?
The bureaucracy, and I think at a local level the party system, which takes people away from actually thinking about what's good for the local people and the local environment, and starts them arguing about things purely on a partisan level, which really just distracts from what we should be doing.
What newspaper do you read?
I'm probably someone who relies more on the online, but if I do, I'm travelling and I buy a paper, it'd probably be the Telegraph or the Times.
This one has been asked for everybody, but just for you. Should we fine parents who take their children out of school for a holiday?
I'm not going to answer that directly. We should fine. There should be a system to control parents taking children away from school in unjustified circumstances. It's not about holidays, this. It's about ensuring the quality of education.
When did you first vote?
When did I first vote? It would have been 1987, I think.
Should the voting age be lowered to 16?
I think it should. I think you might get more engagement with people.
Are you proud of your country?
Yes.
What's the best thing about living on the Isle of Wight?
Oh gosh, there's so many things. The environment.
And what's the worst thing about living on the Isle of Wight?
Some of the politicians. Can I say them? No, I better not say. I've said it now, haven't I?
One word to describe Donald Trump?
Challenging.
Who will win in an arm wrestle between you or Jeremy Corbyn?
I probably would.
Who will win the next general election?
The next general election. Do you know? I don't think we're going to get a winner. I think it's going to be a hung parliament.
Is Britain full up?
Is Britain full up? Technically, no. Practically, maybe yes.
Should Scotland become an independent country?
Now, this is a longer question for me, because probably my first interest in politics, deep interest in politics, arose in Scotland through my first marriage. And I would say I think there is actually a strong basis for Scotland becoming independent. I know there's a potential lot of damage that could happen as a result of that, but Scotland's primarily a different country. And I recognise from that from friends and, as I say, personal involvement in politics. We're talking some time ago. But yeah, I think it's, there are grounds for it to be an independent country.
What would your first policy be if you became Prime Minister?
Increase funding to the Isle of Wight.
So we talked a little bit about the general election there. We've got the council elections coming up in May next year. May the 4th, I believe.
Yep.
An easy one to remember for Star Wars fans. What do you think the chances are of having another Ireland Independence leading the council next year?
I'd like to think there's a good chance, but I think we have a very fractured political situation on the island at the moment, and I think what we're going to have is a situation where it's about people working together. I think we've had that with the Island Independence. We've managed to work together as a group. We've managed to bring others in to our ethos and our approach. You know, if we retain the same number of councillors going forward, I'll be happy with that. I'd obviously be even happier if we have more, but what I'd like to see is that we actually get good councillors, good active councillors, who can work together and, as I said right at the beginning, will have that common bond and that primary belief of saying it's about the island. If we get 40 councillors who do that, I don't care what colour they are, we'll have got a good result for the island and we'll have a win situation. The more we bring party factionalism into it, the more the island loses. So I'd hope that the message I'd like to get across over the coming months is I want to see good people with the right attitude coming forward and standing and being able to work together, and that I regard as a win.
I'm assuming you're saying that you will be standing again for in your ward.
My intention is to stand again, yes.
Can you just tell us a little bit about how you got involved in politics? How did you get to become our leader of the Isle of Wight Council?
I always had a bit of a background academic interest in politics, and as I say, through a previous relationship, I did get quite interested in the Scottish political system. We're talking here about 1990, early 90s, when I suppose the independent movement was really kicking off. I probably then found myself too busy in professional life doing other things, but it really kicked off on the island for me. In 2007, that must have been, as a parent at St Helens Primary School, when the school reorganisation process started and St Helens School was put under threat. I got extremely involved in that campaign. I had a legal background, so I think I sort of stuck out as someone who was going to get asked by all the concerned parents and the concerned community I'd already joined the parish council through as well by that point, but I was asked if I could help. I think I would have done that anyway because I got really, really worried about how I was seeing things being done in that process. I thought it was a system, a proposal, and process that was handled appallingly, and I think I just reacted to that. And in addition to the work in relation to St Helens School, I think the things I continually found myself finding out about how things were being done, what attitudes there were, made me think there's got to be a better way than this, and I ended up standing in the 2009 council election.
In the last just few minutes, what I'd like to do is hand it over to you for a kind of, especially as it's nearly Christmas, a kind of Christmas message, like a mini manifesto of what you would like to see happen in the next year with the council and with the island independence.
With the council, I'd like to think that we would start working together. I don't think we will until the election. I think things have become too fractured and too many people have got their election heads on. But we still have important work to do in getting ourselves a working budget, trying to save some of our services, trying to get the process of regeneration underway on the island. Those are the key things I'd like to work at. In a wider context, I'd also like to think that we could do as much as we can to deal with something we haven't spoken about yet, the current problems facing healthcare and the NHS and the island. I think there's so many concerns there, and particularly the proposals in relation to local surgeries and GPs. That's something we really need to deal with, try and change proposals, which again are very damaging for the island, particularly as an island community, particularly with that barrier of water, which means some services are becoming increasingly difficult. Medical services are becoming increasingly difficult to access because the attitude to what needs to be provided on the island is not the right one and is not being done with the interests of islanders at heart.
What would you like to see in terms of healthcare for the island and provision for the island? Do you think
we
it should remain
hospital,
as it is?
We need our local GPs. We need a system that actually responds to the fact that we have a very high proportion of elderly people on the island. We do, possibly because it's a nice place to be, have quite a lot of intensive needs for the service, for services dealing with disability, mental conditions, etc. They're all things that are struggling in the current system and do need to be supported, because we do have particular pressures here on the island. So it just, again, it needs to be funded and supported properly. I think the NHS is a body that wastes a lot of money, and we shouldn't be the ones who suffer from that when government's trying to sort it out. It does need sorting out, but it does not need sorting out in a way that's going to prejudice us. So, as I say, I think that support for the health system and looking at developing the island, regeneration and solving our financial issues, those are the key things immediately on the island. You asked the question in a wider term in terms of the island independence. As I say, I'd just like to think that we would go into the election process, or indeed come out of the election process, with a group of councillors who can work together, and I think that's more likely to be those who are focused on the island and island residents rather than those who are carrying the can for a particular political ideology, so that that work in relation to fighting the healthcare reforms and ensuring the financial security and sustainability of the island, I think we have a much greater chance of doing that with an approach that is independent, by which I mean independent of party politics, but very much tied in with the island and its residents and the desire to make the best of that future.
Okay, thank you very much for coming on the show today. Hopefully we'll be able to hear from you again before the election next year.
Certainly,
it's been
yes.
Good to hear about lots of different issues as well. Thank you very much. Next week on the show, we're hoping to have PC Finch, Jonathan Finch, who is one of the key players in for schools on the island. He's a governor of the Island Innovation Trust.
I know Joe, he's an excellent man. I just thought his letter to the MP recently was fantastic.
Yes,
I really support what he's doing there.
And he is hopefully coming to talk about that letter and also about his kind of his work and support for LGBTQ people on the island. The week after that, it's Christmas Eve, and we've got two of my students, one who actually lives in Switzerland now, and the other who's from the island, and they're both, I think they're 12 or 13, and they're going to be debating all sorts of political issues on the island, having a good discussion about that, which should be a really interesting show just before Christmas. Up next, we have Darren Street with lots of lovely music. Thank you for joining me for the last 4 hours for our Panto special and then the political soapbox.
Plug? I'm back on at 5 o'clock.
Oh, brilliant.
Part five of the musical history of Led Zeppelin.
Excellent.
Because I do have a bit of a life outside
that's
politics,
good.
And that's part of it.
Fantastic. Yeah, make sure you all tune into that. Thank you very much, Jonathan, for coming on, and I'll see you soon.
Thank you. www.vectisradio.com